Thank you, Dr. Smith. If you need any old prints, yes, you know where to turn.
The site is called Old Masters.
The next panelist is Mark Royden Winchell. Dr. Winchell received his PhD from Vanderbilt University and has been teaching at Clemson University since 1985. His publications include books on Joan Didion, William F. Buckley, Leslie Fiedler, Herman Talmadge, Cleanth Brooks, and Donald Davidson. I especially recommend his books on Brooks and Davidson. Cleanth Brooks and the Rise of Modern Criticism won the Center for Robert Penn Warren Studies Award for its outstanding contribution to literary criticism. Where No Flag Flies, Donald Davidson and the Southern Resistance will likely be the definitive biography of the most stalwart of the agrarians. Anyone who has or wants to understand the true Southern spirit will want to read this book. Dr. Winchell writes for a host of university quarterlies and conservative magazines of scholarship and opinion, and he is currently working on or about to bring out the authorized biography of literary critic Leslie Fiedler.
Thank you, Michael. The title of my talk is The Anti-Southern Strategy. At high noon on Saturday, July 1, 2000, three flags over the Capitol Dome at the State House in Columbia, South Carolina were lowered. The top two flags, representing the federal government of the United States and the state of South Carolina, went back up. The third flag dropped inside the dome and was presented to Governor Jim Hodges by two cadets from the Citadel, one black, one white. The crowd gathered on the Capitol grounds grew silent as Confederate reenactors, dressed in gray and butternut, marched toward a Confederate soldier's monument to the steady beat of two snare drums. They carried with them a small square flag like the ones actually borne by Confederate soldiers across the battlefield of a war that had not yet been forgotten. Protected by 300 law enforcement officers, including sharpshooters positioned on the State House roof, and 30 state troopers standing shoulder to shoulder in a grassy area near the soldiers' monument, the reenactors attached the square flag to a lanyard and raised it on a 30-foot bronze pole. The assembled crowd erupted in a cacophony of rebel whoops. This brief ceremony marked the formal end of a controversy that had divided the state of South Carolina for more than a decade. It had prompted an economic boycott of the state by the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and had been the focus of intense media coverage, most of it negative. Also, because of the importance of South Carolina's early Republican primary, the controversy had been an issue in the last two presidential campaigns. The question that tore South Carolina apart like nothing since the war between the states itself was the presence of a Confederate battle flag on the Capitol Dome. This was the offending symbol that Governor Hodges had received from the two Citadel cadets. Its removal from the dome to the State House grounds enabled politicians to turn their attention to other matters, even as Southern traditionalists felt betrayed and the NAACP remained unsatisfied. Like most political compromises, this one was based more on expediency than principle. The Confederate battle flag was originally raised over the Capitol Dome in Columbia as part of the centennial celebration of the war between the states in 1861. The following year, the state legislature passed a joint resolution that the flag should fly in perpetuity. Although not everyone was happy with the situation, no formal effort was made to remove the flag for the next 10 years. Between 1972 and 1992, various legislators unsuccessfully introduced resolutions that would have brought the flag down. By the early 90s, both the flag and the opposition to it seemed to be a permanent part of the political landscape of South Carolina. Despite their persistent efforts, the organized pressure groups on the left were unable to eliminate this defiant reminder of the state's Confederate past. That would be a job for the Republican right. The first culprit in our rogues gallery of anti-Confederate conservatives is David Beasley. Upon his election as governor of South Carolina in 1994, Beasley was viewed as a rising star in the political firmament. By 2000, Bill Clinton would be out of the White House, and the Republicans might well be looking for their own Southern governor to put on the national ticket. It wasn't long before Ralph Reed, executive director of the Christian Coalition, began hinting that the religious right would look favorably on a Beasley candidacy. To assure his own reelection in 1998, all Beasley had to do was avoid a major political misstep. To earn a place in the national spotlight, however, he needed some dramatic accomplishment, preferably one that played against anti-Southern stereotypes. Remember how much mileage Jimmy Carter got out of hanging Martin Luther King's portrait in the Capitol in Atlanta 25 years earlier? Shortly after Bill Clinton trounced Bob Dole in the 1996 presidential election, it occurred to Beasley that getting rid of that pesky banner on the Capitol dome might be his ticket to national office, maybe even the cultural equivalent of Nixon going to China. All that he had to do was find a plausible way of reneging on his campaign promise not to remove the flag. Eventually, all successful politicians have to develop the ability to go back on what they pledged to do when running for office. Most simply argue that circumstances have changed. Few have the candor of Earl Long, who once explained the difference between his word and his deed by saying, "I lied." Obviously, the changed circumstances line wouldn't work with a Confederate flag. The only thing that had changed since 1994 was that a nearly bankrupt NAACP had latched onto the flag issue as a way of replenishing its coffers. So, Parson Beasley took the only avenue open to him. He declared that God had told him to take the flag down. This revelation was announced in a statewide television speech in which he invoked the names of all his Confederate ancestors. And one is reminded of the Borscht Belt comedian who tells a string of anti-Semitic jokes and then declares, "It's all right, I'm Jewish." The only people who could possibly fail to be stirred were a few benighted rednecks, and there was no way they would vote for the party of Jesse Jackson in a presidential election. Office holders in South Carolina were a bit more parochial in their assessment of the situation. Unfortunately for them, a disproportionate number of the flag-loving rednecks were registered to vote in South Carolina. Immediately after Beasley spoke, two other public officials, Attorney General Charlie Condon and State Senator Glenn McConnell, appeared to rebut his position. So united was the media in their opposition to the flag that South Carolina's public television network initially refused to air any rebuttal. Exemplifying what Tom Wolfe once called mau-mauing the flag catchers, the nominally Republican State Superintendent of Education, Barbara Nielsen, claimed that providing equal time would, quote, be a threat to public safety. Even after the network was forced to air the rebuttals, most affiliate stations simply refused to carry them. In Greenville, where all three speeches were heard, a station conducted a call-in poll to gauge public sentiment. The pro-flag position won hands down. Now, because the anti-flag Democrats could not easily capitalize on Beasley's dilemma no major Democrat challenged him for re-election. There were only the perennial crank candidates and State Representative Jim. By keeping quiet about the flag and promising to start a state lottery that would miraculously push South Carolina's SAT scores up to 49th in the nation, Hodges pulled off a comfortable upset victory. And David Beasley was retired to that purgatory of ex-politicians, a teaching position at the Kennedy School of Government. Exit polls showed that the solidly Republican Party wasn't so solid after all. 22% of those who voted for Hodges were Republicans, primarily interested in expressing their dissatisfaction with Beasley. Although estimates differ, flag supporters constituted a significant percentage of the defectors. Even though Beasley had backtracked on his proposal to move the flag, he did not reveal whether he had made a second pilgrimage to Mount Sinai. Voters who felt betrayed were out to punish him. Hodges might not be entirely trustworthy, but he would surely get the message that messing with the flag after promising not to was political suicide. What flag supporters had not reckoned with was the power of the cultural elites. In a war of attrition, it is possible to lose almost every battle and yet emerge victorious. Like the Viet Cong, hardened opponents of the flag realized that if they stayed around long enough and made enough noise, the softer members of the enemy camp would eventually get tired and sue for peace. As usual, the business community led the way in caving in to the forces of political correctness. Corporate leaders are always susceptible to organized pressure. Because it's cheaper to pay the Mau Maus off than it is to stand on principle, business tycoons are easy prey to shake down artists such as Jesse Jackson. As Lenin himself observed, when it came time for the communists to hang the last of the bourgeoisie, there'd be a capitalist there to sell them the rope. For South Carolina's rope salesman, the flag issue was nothing more than a matter of public relations. Charles Hamel, publisher of Southern Partisan, put it best when he wrote, and I quote, "Like America's greatest entrepreneur, Henry Ford, most of the Palmetto State CEOs believe that history is bunk. Their chief goal in life is to entice Yankees and foreigners to come to South Carolina, either as builders of plants and factories or as tourists," end quote. Perhaps the most ludicrous argument of all was that the state must furl the flag if it wanted to attract German car manufacturers. Bavarian Motor Works had already located near Greenville despite the presence of the Confederate flag in Columbia. Besides, given that little unpleasantness known as the Holocaust, it seemed a bit presumptuous for Germans to be lecturing other people about race relations. In spite of these accumulated pressures, the flag would probably still be flying today had the controversy been confined to South Carolina. As it turns out, the efforts of the NAACP to nationalize the issue got an unlikely boost from the party of Lincoln. Even more than in previous years, it appeared that in 2000, the South Carolina primary could decide the Republican presidential nomination. It came as no surprise that candidates were grilled about their views on the Confederate flag. John McCain said contradictory things, depending on which audience he was addressing, while George W. Bush, who had done much to betray the Confederate heritage of his home state of Texas, consistently maintained the placement of the Confederate flag was a matter for South Carolinians to decide. National politicians who were not seeking votes in the Palmetto State proved far less reticent to state position. If the Republicans had pursued a Southern strategy in the late 60s and early 70s, they now seem to have hit upon an anti-Southern strategy. Part of the reason for this was nothing more than a desire to reach out to blacks and white moderates who bought into the demonology purveyed by the NAACP. Virginia's Governor Jim Gilmore, who proudly calls himself the state's CEO, has aggressively attacked Confederate symbols in his state. Not surprisingly, he is now National Republican Party chairman. The liberal Republican governor of New York, George Pataki, removed the Georgia state flag from a display in the state capitol in Albany because it contained the Confederate battle flag as part of its design. Georgians have since bowed to the zeitgeist and changed the pattern of their flag to something more politically correct. Finally, after the voters relieved him of the burden of his presidential candidacy, John McCain pulled an Earl Long. He admitted that he had lied for political advantage when he failed to chastise South Carolinians for flying the stars and bars. Although no one in the South had told George Pataki what flag to fly in New York, or expressed an opinion about the appearance of the Capitol Dome in McCain's home state of Arizona, politicians from there and seemingly everywhere else knew exactly what ought to be done in South Carolina. In terms of unsolicited advice, the most helpful outsiders were pundits and intellectuals representing the national conservative establishment. These folks used to be called neoconservatives before they became so powerful that the prefix seemed kind of pointless. The neoconservative best known to the general public was William Bennett, and so it was no surprise that he started going on talk shows accusing George W. Bush of moral cowardice for not denouncing the Confederate flag. For neoconservatives, moral cowardice consists of being reluctant to stick your nose into other people's business. Bennett's words carried a certain authority because he had gotten rich affixing his names to books about virtue that were actually written by an anonymous staffer. Bennett, of course, is a great admirer of that other highly moral plagiarist, Dr. King. If Bill Bennett did not invent the anti-Southern strategy, it had first been used on his behalf by neocons desperate to prevent the Southern traditionalist Mel Bradford from becoming director of the National Endowment for the Humanities. It should have come as no surprise that Bill Bennett's position on the Confederate flag would be less an anomaly than a trendsetter among designer conservatives. National Review, which had been the house organ of the conservative establishment since 1955, treated the flag as a joke. Early in its history, NR had published Southern traditionalists such as Donald Davidson and Richard Weaver, and that unreconstructed copperhead Russell Kirk was one of the magazine's founding editors. Moreover, for 25 years, Mel Bradford had been a frequent and valued contributor. This openness to traditionalist Southern views changed dramatically in the 1990s, when the end of the Cold War accentuated differences within the conservative movement. From that point on, any reference to the Confederacy in NR read as if it could have been scripted by Kwesi Mfume. The magazine's young editor, Rich Lowry, who wasn't even born until 7 years after the flag had been raised in Columbia, dismissed Southern traditionalists as rednecks. In the only article in the magazine devoted to the flag issue, David Shiflett concluded that, quote, there is no grace and decorum in South Carolina's use of the flag, and there is no substitute for those, end quote. Shiflett neglected to mention whether he found grace and decorum in the linkage that flag bashers frequently made between the Confederacy and Nazi Germany. Back in the halcyon days of Pat Buchanan and Michael Kinsley, one could always tune in Crossfire on CNN for a lively intellectual debate. Unfortunately, Buchanan and Kinsley had moved on to other endeavors, and their replacements were little more than partisan spinmeisters. When Crossfire tackled the issue of the flag, the conservative voice, Bush family toady Mary Madeline, simply dredged up all of the pro-Confederate proclamations Bill Clinton had signed as governor of Arkansas. Republicans in the South might be bad, she seemed to say, but the Democrats were even worse. The Fox News Channel, often seen as a conservative alternative to CNN, proved no better. Sean Hannity, the conservative half of the team of Hannity and Combs, pointed out that bad as the flag might be, it had been raised during the gubernatorial administration of Democrat Fritz Hollings. Well, the war of attrition finally took its toll. The people of South Carolina did not turn away from the flag so much as they did from the controversy that was drowning out all other issues. Like the harried CEO who asked his lawyer, "What will it take to make this go away?" Many South Carolinians were hopeful that some Solomonic compromise would enable them to get on with their lives. When the legislature voted to remove the Confederate battle flag from the Capitol Dome and hoist a similar, more historically accurate flag at the Confederate Soldiers Monument on the State House grounds, legislators who had vowed never to take it down were forced to eat their words. Only 7 state senators voted against the compromise. Although they had not gotten the unconditional surrender they sought and vowed to continue their economic boycott of the state, the leaders of the NAACP were clear winners in this confrontation. Throughout the nation, South Carolina included, students were being expelled from school if they displayed the flag on their clothing or belongings. Workers were losing their jobs for similar reasons, for similar offenses. With the striking of the Stars and Bars from the Capitol Dome in Columbia, the thought police everywhere were greatly emboldened, and their allies in the conservative establishment had discovered the allure of political correctness. Thank you.